The 2011 Penn Hemingway Award-winning novelist Brando Skyhorse grew up believing that he was the son of an incarcerated American Indian political activist. But he soon discovered that his mother, Maria, who called herself Running Deer, had been lying all along, and that his real father was an immigrant who had abandoned the family when Brando was 3 years old. In his new memoir, Take This Man, he writes about his Los Angeles childhood in the Mexican-American neighborhood of Echo Park, his mother's many husbands, and how he eventually tracked down his biological father. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased to welcome Brando Skyhorse to our show today.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Your memoir got a great review in the New York Times Book Review this past Sunday. Are you surprised by how much press it has received?
I mean, it is. It's kind of extraordinary to me, but I think there's something in this book that resonates with people.
The reviewer described it as agony with a twist and commended it for not being a predictable tale of irresponsible parenting. Is that how you see your story? And like the reviewer, do you think of it as the new agonist?
There was so much to chew on that review, which was written by Rhoda Jansen, who wrote her own phenomenal book, Mennonite in a Black Dress. So I love the phrase, agony with a twist, made it sound like a cocktail. But yeah, I think it has to be sort of palatable. You can't really lock readers up in a really dark room for 300 pages and then expect them, you know, not to want to get out. You got to liven the situation up a little bit.
Did your mother always tell you that your father was a Native American?
Yeah, she was pretty specific on that from the beginning. And, you know, more specifically, I believe that I was an American Indian until I was about 12 or 13 years old, which sounds absurd because I lived in this neighborhood which was predominantly Mexican-American and Vietnamese. And, you know, my grandmother, who also lived with us, she spoke fluent Spanish and she got ashes on Ash Wednesday, was a very devout Catholic. And so I was in this situation where if I just looked around, it was like, wait a minute, you must be Mexican. But my mother was such a powerful storyteller, it was hard to, you know,
but many Mexicans have Indian past, you know, heritage of their own.
Sure.
So, in fact, if you look at somebody who's Navajo and somebody who's a Mexican, often they look like they could be related.
I think that's a really excellent point, and that's probably one of the reasons that my mother was able to keep up the charade for as many years as they have, because people have asked me, oh, well, you know, you're in this neighborhood. Nobody ever questioned you or made any comments on you. You know, she went also, when I was very young, she would take me to neighborhoods on the west side of Los Angeles, which was predominantly Anglo at the time, and, you know, she could pass herself off because of the sharp cheekbones. If you look at pictures of her and me, they could say, yeah, these two people are clearly American Indian.
But didn't your grandmother also claim to?
Yeah, my grandmother was somebody who enabled my mother more than she probably should have. I think part of that was fear. I think she was afraid of my mother a little bit, the sort of creation that she had made. But I think my grandmother also was a fan of stories as well. My grandmother loved old movies, and I think she was sort of excited by this idea that she could take this sort of really fantastical narrative and run with it.
Echo Park is now kind of like Williamsburg or Greenpoint, but when you were a kid, it was pretty much what you call the most beautiful ghetto in America.
That's a pretty accurate description. I actually live in Bushwick right now, and that area is going through the same process of gentrification. And yeah, I mean, back then in the 70s, you know, I'm not going to say that it was like drive-bys every night, but there would be police helicopters, and, you know, the sounds of police sirens were a very familiar sound. And so there were those kinds of distractions if that's what you were interested in.
Echo Park is also the setting for your first novel, The Madonnas of Echo Park, which won you the Penn Hemingway Award in 2011. How autobiographical was that book?
You know, I knew that I'd been working, that this memoir was coming, so I tried to keep the autobiographical stuff in the memoir. I had this really phenomenal writing instructor, Jeffrey Wolfe, who wrote his own phenomenal memoir, The Duke of Deception.
The brother of a great memoirist,
yes,
as well.
Exactly. What a family, right? So he was very specific and said, you know, there are two kinds of writing. The stuff that basically you the fiction, basically, you put this in one box, and the nonfiction, you put it in another box. So it was pretty clear to keep both of those strands separate.
Because there are some writers who you figure out the whole story by reading the fiction, the nonfiction, eventually.
Well, also, I didn't want book buyers to double dip and feel like I was double dipping, getting paid to write the same book twice. So
You describe your grandmother as the unofficial mayor of Echo Park. So she was a larger-than-life character.
Yeah, she was just really one of those characters. And I feel like every one of those neighborhoods, like Bushwick, Greenpoint, there's these old ladies that basically, you know, they have these incredible backstories. And they just know everybody. They talk to everybody. And they've been there for years. And, yeah, my grandmother was that person in Echo Park.
You say your mother was a great storyteller. Was she a storyteller or a liar? She told you once that she was almost one of Ted Bundy's victims.
You know, I think she was both, you know, but I think there
was that
always,
likely?
Probably not. But, you know, I think there was always a kernel of truth in every single one of my mother's stories. So when I did a little research, you know, to kind of go back and try to figure out what was true and what was fake in this memoir, I'd always find that, oh, this is how this fantastical story originated. And it always started with something really basic and really simple that she would just blow up into something much larger.
Did you always believe the stories when she told you?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, because the stories were so phenomenal and fantastical. And also, I was really desperate for my mother's attention. And that was a way for me to – the best way I could get her attention was to believe everything she said.
You're right. She wasn't an Indian, but she was the perfect Indian storyteller.
Yeah, there was this quote in the book where Sherman Alexie, who's this phenomenal American Indian writer, you know, he was joking and said, you know, Indians have to be careful around non-Indians because we just make stuff up. And I think my mother kind of took that mantra literally. I think it was her way of feeling like she could be more than just an ordinary Mexican-American girl in an ordinary Mexican-American neighborhood.
My guest is Brando Skyhorse, his memoir, Take This Man. Well, since he wasn't your father, how do you wind up with the last name Skyhorse? Is that the name on your birth certificate?
No, the name on my birth certificate is Brando Kelly Ulloa, U-L-L-O-A. And my Mexican father abandoned me and my mother when I was 3 years old. So my mother did what any good woman would do, is she went father shopping and she answered an ad, or she put an ad in this magazine. And this man named Paul Skyhorse Johnson, who was incarcerated for armed robbery, he responded. And I basically became his son.
And your mother suggested that she had had an illicit affair while she was married to Candido Ulloa. Ulloa, I guess it is.
Yes.
And did he believe her?
I think so. But I think, again, it's like, you know, my mother required so much charity because the amount of delusion was, if you really trace it back, was really kind of staggering. So, yeah, I think there was really this desperation to want to believe her because she was so convincing and so believed in the past. She was so passionate about these narratives.
But you suggest that she didn't even have an affair with Paul Skyhorse Johnson.
No. I mean, I think it was one of those things where she was basically a groupie. I mean, I don't know what the popular term for this, fangirl, whatever you want to call it, but she was so desperate to integrate herself into this world that she just basically made her own narratives up, and that was what she proceeded to tell other people. You know, for years, I literally thought that Marlon Brando was my godfather. Like, you know, and also he played the godfather, so it was incredibly confusing.
She told you that?
Oh, yeah.
But she obviously named you after
She
him.
Named me after. And so, again, it seemed plausible. And there were other people who were, you know, who were tricked by my mom's deception as well. There is a father figure in the book, the man I basically consider my father now, Frank. And he's been in my life for about 30 years. When he met her, that's the story she told him.
Well, there were a whole bunch of fathers. Your mother was a kind of a serial monogamist, but they would come along for a couple of years and then you'd have another father. Did she marry any of these men?
Well, there were ceremonies. You know, I think there was like a Baha'i faith ceremony. There was a wedding in Vegas. There was a sort of non-denominational ceremony. So, yeah, in the loosest sense, there were commitment ceremonies. There were marriages, but they certainly weren't legal.
What about Paul Skyhorse Johnson? You compare him to Will Sampson, the American Indian chief from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Sure.
Did you know him?
No. I had like no prior knowledge of who he was. The first time I met him was when he was in jail. That was when I was 5 years old. So,
did he say he was your father?
Yeah. Yeah, basically he sort of gave me this like warm embrace and said, my little big chief. And so he carried the deception along with me. So it was incredibly confusing because, you know, again, obviously, why would this man lie to me? But he was also in jail. So...
Well, you write that you were father rich but family poor. How many fathers did you have?
I had 5 fathers total, and that's not including my biological father, Candy, though, so that's about 6.
But Frank is the one you considered that. He's the last one?
He's the last one, and we're still in contact right now.
Is it difficult to grow close to a new father every 3 years or so?
Oh, of course.
Especially when you're really poor?
Of course. When you're really poor and you're really young and you're desperate for any kind of paternal leadership, it's really heartbreaking. And they always follow the same pattern where basically first I hated them, then I slowly grew to trust them, then I loved them, and then they left.
And they wound up supporting you while they were there, but then your mother had to take jobs when there were no fathers?
For a number of years, my mother worked as a phone sex operator.
And well, she's somebody who made up stories.
Yeah, it was kind of a natural fit for her, to be perfectly frank, because a number of the men that came into the house, you know, they were sort of like bounders. I mean, they were basically like, I'm going to go off and hang out at the beach for a day, and then we wouldn't see them for 3 days. So the economic responsibility really fell to her.
And do phone sex operators make a lot of money?
They did in the 80s, and especially if you're not paying any rent and you're not contributing to grocery money and you're not paying any taxes. Yeah, the money was not bad for somebody who lived in Echo Park and had most of those finances covered.
What made you decide to track down your biological father? Was your mother still alive when that happened?
No, my mother passed away years ago, and she was 50 years old. She was very young. She had lived a sedentary lifestyle and was cocktailing fenfen with speed in order to lose weight. And so basically what enabled me to do this was I had writer's block. I didn't know how to begin this book, and so a friend of mine suggested, why don't you see if you can find your father? And I thought, oh, this is going to take years. And it was there on whitepages.com. It took all of 10 minutes.
You were about 36 or so.
Yeah, I was about 36 or so, yeah.
And you had never reached out before.
I knew his name, and I felt like I didn't know what I wanted to say to him. And again, I was intimidated by what I thought was going to be an incredibly difficult search process, and it turned out to be quite easy.
Where was he living?
He was living in Whittier, California, which was 30 minutes away from where I grew up, and he basically had moved there, and he had been there all this time, hiding in plain sight. And what's more—
Did he have another family?
Yeah, he had a family. He remarried right after my mom, and he gave birth to 3 beautiful daughters. So I have 3 new sisters, and he had pictures of me that were basically hidden in plain sight in his photo album. And when they found out it was me, my middle sister Karen, he said, "Oh, we thought you were just one of those cousins. You know, we didn't know he was actually a brother."
Has he ever explained why he never contacted you?
He was afraid. He was afraid. And, we haven't had a long conversation about it, but he was very intimidated by my mother, and I guess he felt that if he got back in touch with her, the consequences would have been severe.
Despite learning that Candido was your father, a Mexican immigrant, you haven't changed your name. Do you still identify as an American Indian?
It's really interesting because I've been asked several times, well, you found your father. Wouldn't your father be proud to have, your name attached to him, especially because it comes from a family of like 3 daughters? And it's just the name that I've attached with so much that I really can't imagine myself being anything else. And so it's weird. I identify as Mexican, but I also acknowledge that I was raised as a piecemeal American Indian. And it's still kind of a complicated situation for me.
Of course, your father's last name is harder to pronounce. Ulloa is a lot harder.
It's a little harder
than
to get
Skyhorse.
Reservations in restaurants as well.
You sound so normal despite everything that you've lived through. Do you still have a lot of issues you got to work through?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But certainly not as many issues if I hadn't gone to therapy for a number of years or been on antidepressants.
And then writing a novel that is received so well.
Well, yeah, it helps
hurt
to get all this out in the open. So.
Just think if you got only rejection slips.
Don't put any ideas in my head. No, it's been a really phenomenal process. And again, I'm aware of the fact that what I do is a privilege. And I think that is really what inspires me and encourages me to keep going and not to dwell so much on the dark stuff.
Are you teaching?
Yeah, I'm going to be teaching at George Washington University this fall. I'm going to be a visiting writer there, and I'm really excited to give it a try.
And Brando Skyhorse will be giving a reading tonight at 7:30 at Jimmy's number 43. That's at 43 East 7th Street near 2nd Avenue. The book, his memoir, is called Take This Man, and it is published by Simon & Schuster. Are you going back to fiction after this?
Oh, God, yes. This is...
Many people say fiction is harder.
Well, I love spending time with my family, and it's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful read, but I need some time off. And fiction is basically the place where I can take my time off. So, yeah, I'm really eager to get back to it.
Even though it's harder than just remembering back and telling the story you already know?
Yeah, kind of. I'm looking for a new challenge. I'm looking for it to be hard.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Glad to be here.